Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
How you doing, brother?
How about you?
Oh, well, there's a great meme going around. Maybe you've seen it. And it's a little cartoon of a woman on the phone, old school phone, saying, no, I can't come out tonight. I'm watching the final season of the United States of America.
Yeah, you know, it's like,
are you having political dread?
Yeah, I am. It's the car crash in slow motion that bothers me. It's the paralysis of it all, and I feel like it's one thing to try and fail, but I think it's another thing to kind of collectively understand that there's a that we're on a dead end, but there's like no, either there's no will or there's no mechanism. And I think it has more to do with it that the mechanism is absent to like change course. And so we're all just forced to participate in this, you know, it's a spectacle that gets more absurd every cycle. Everybody knows it.
I can offer the words of D-Hawk. Things are so bad and have been for so long. There's just no time for pessimism.
I hear you on that. And what I'm not pessimistic about is people.
Hey,
Thomas.
Sorry, I was on a run cleaning house this morning, and I just lost track of time. But the house is pretty clean.
You must be avoiding writing.
I'm getting it from two different. That's exactly right. And that Needy always says that the place is so clean. He's like, I am avoiding writing. And but the other thing is, when I was down with the cancer treatment, man, I couldn't do any of that shit at all. So the other thing on the upside now is I have a new gratitude for being able to do the simplest things.
Yeah.
You know, I would get up and just think I was going to vacuum a room. And it's like, I would do that. And then I would go lay that down and just be out for the rest of the day. So had that, but it hasn't stopped being a wonderful way. And I don't call it avoiding writing. I call it, I'm getting ready to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I want everything to be neat and clean before I start. Yeah.
Everything is part of the writing process. I agree, because epiphanies aren't going to come on the fifth edit. They're going to come on the bicycle or taking out the trash
Of course, the muse loves to strike in the shower because we're fucking naked and we don't have a pen. You know? Or when we're driving. All right. Anyway, thanks for being patient with me.
Well, welcome to the podcast. Mm-hmm. We've got Joe C. and Tom Rutledge here. And
all right, now I really want to play Alan. We miss you, but we're going to have a good time.
Right. We'll have a good time in honor of Alan.
It's always an honor of Alan.
What do we say? We let Patrick talk now. Come on. What? Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Patrick.
I was going to say, I want to circle back to Tom, and I want to check in with him and ask a little bit about his emotional sobriety. But beyond the cleaning, let's go deeper. How are things?
Good. I'm not a guy who thinks in terms of measuring emotional sobriety. I'm a person that thinks in terms of applying emotional sobriety. It's a practical philosophy to be applied. So I don't know ever how to, you know, I think if we want to measure how we're doing, we really have to do that with hindsight, because I don't know, we could always give a not only a measure but a story about how we're doing at any given time. But if you checked back, it'd be an interesting study. If you check back 6 months from now and ask about this time what was going on, it would be a different story. So really, by my most honest answer to how's your emotional sobriety is, how the hell would I know now?
That is honest.
That's quite beautiful. I found I've been quite happy lately. it's exhausting because my homeostasis is not there. It's, you know, lower expectations, more stoic. This happiness requires muscles that I haven't been using. And so I was just noticing that. And I'm liking it, but I need a lot of naps. And we were talking about writing earlier when we were off mic, and yeah, I just put together something about the Plain Language Big Book, which I thought I'd put together in a weekend, and that was 6 weeks ago, right? Just more research, find this, how do I incorporate this into it? Like, it just, you know, that's rolling with taking life as it comes, which is emotional sobriety. And it's great to have it done or done for now.
It's not that I distrust myself. I just don't think I'm probably the most, I will have the most accurate assessment that I will have with hindsight. You know, give me a little bit and I'll look back and I'll know. It's, but that's not to say that we don't want to be mindful and conscious of it as we go along. But when you said I've been happy for a while, you just had this sort of, I don't know, trepidation or at least suspicion in your eye, you know, like you're looking around, like you're waiting for somebody to barge in the door, you know. And I just know that feeling. It's like, you know, it's the old deal of like, it's quiet outside. It's too quiet.
Almost too quiet.
Yeah, we hear that on the Westerns, you know, when we're waiting for the enemy to attack. But I love the plain, what is it called?
Plain Language Big Book.
Great.
It's Alcoholics Anonymous is doing it. I mean, the reality is, what do you call Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Like, now that we have printing on demand and, you know, do-it-yourself publishing, you know, that we have big books from a feminine perspective and secular big books and, you know, like all of these adaptations that incorporate, you know, neurodivergence and trauma, right? You know, like, we didn't wait for the General Service Office, you know, to bring,
right,
you know, slabs of the, you know, Ten Commandment, like, new, we just do what we need, right? But General Service has identified that the big book isn't reaching people. The literacy rate doesn't reach over half of the people who are coming into our rooms today. So they did something about it. And I think that's a, you know, if you didn't think they'd ever rewrite the big book, you're not alone. And they're not getting rid of the old one. It's a compendium to the original. And I think that's the right way to go. Yes, and make everybody happy, right? The people who treat it like a lullaby, you know, they want it to stay the same, just like their grand sponsor used to read it to them to put them to bed. You know, that's great. You know, keep that. The people who need something more contemporary, more, 21st century, they should have that too.
Well, that's what we've been doing anyway. I mean, writing it. That's what a sponsor does. Helps the new person put this into plain language. You know, let's read this step. Let's do this step. Let's talk about it. What does it mean in practical terms? It's like, so it's just a matter of putting into writing and having it available for more people. That's great.
Yeah.
Joe, I intuit that part of the reason you're always pushing towards the frontier of recovery and kind of like interpreting this writing and stuff is that you're just so, you live and breathe it and you're so in it that you've just heard Freebird too many times. Like, let's just get something new. You know, let's shake it up.
There are no too many times. It's not possible. It's like,
yeah, that's right. That's why there's three guitar parts, like Hotel California.
Yeah. So, Tom, just briefly, you mentioned Westerns, and I just saw a really good one. I saw Kevin Costner's new Western. It's called Horizon, an American Saga.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
It's good. It's not doing too well in theaters right now, understandably. You know, it's like I don't know, Westerns are kind of a hard sell the further out you get from their inception, but this is a really good one. And it made me feel pretty good for the 3 hours I was watching it. So,
I love Westerns, so I'm looking forward to it.
will Dee Dee watch those with you, or is that kind of like
No, no,
a
Dee, yeah, we like Westerns. One of my favorite Westerns that is like I could say it's a fairly new movie, but of course, if we're talking to people who are younger than us, it's an old movie, but it's Silverado,
Yeah, Lawrence Kasdan.
which is really the first place we ever saw Kevin Costner. He was cut out of the Big Chill, and because he was the kid guy that died,
That's a good Trivial Pursuit
and for that
factoid.
reason, I read that who, I can't remember who the people are involved with, but the whoever is responsible for cutting him out, basically said, I'm going to get something for you, and that something was Silverado, and he played the young kid. It was kind of wild, and loved that character. It was cool.
His forehead technically is in it, and his slashed wrists.
His front, his yeah, he's they're buttoning his shirt, I think. Yes.
So wait, he was in the movie, right? And then they edited him out
Yeah,
later.
there was all this stuff, these sort of like looking back
There were
in when he was
flashbacks and
alive,
stuff
the flashback type
with the
stuff.
guy who had died. Yeah.
They shot all that and didn't use any of it.
That reminds me a little bit, Jean-Claude Van Damme's first major screen role was as the Predator in Predator. And then they fired him like partway through the production. He was out there in the jungle wearing like a rubber suit because they wanted somebody who would be deft with the acrobatics and stuff. And anyway, this is before he was on movie posters of his own, and he was just completely jettisoned at a certain point early on, which I just think is funny, just imagining Jean-Claude Van Damme in a big frog suit like out in the jungle somewhere and wondering, why am I here? And this doesn't seem to be working out. So
Just
apropos
trying to make a
nothing.
buck.
How are you, Patrick?
I'm okay. I'm about to proceed to do some therapy with my mom. I think I'm gonna try and improve a relationship that has just been kind of coasting for a little while. And I think like my relationship with my parents was in such awful straits at the time I got sober that these last 6 years have been a knitting back together. And I think like there's probably ways that this relationship can be improved. There's some like unhealthy kind of recurring like dynamics I feel like between us. And I'm probably getting a little ahead of myself. I haven't popped the question to her about let's do some therapy, but it just seems like a good it seems like a, if I want to make it better, like I will
She'll
probably
hear
need
it
to.
on a podcast.
Oh yes, yeah, she doesn't. If she is listening, I mean that would be awesome if somehow it got to her, but I don't think she listens. This is my private public thing with you guys. But
So you're making an assumption that she's going to say yes.
oh, well, no, I mean, my assumption is she's going to resist it, actually. I don't know.
Okay.
She has been to therapy before, and she's one of those people that, thinks she's too smart to really for therapy to be effective on her.
Yeah, like couples need therapy, and like therapists know this because they're in therapy, right? They bring their kids to a mediator, right? To another therapist when there's difficulty, because you need help with things, fixing your car, picking the right, size nails for the job. All of these things have people who know shit you don't know that can help you out. And having a therapist, if she does engage in this, that would be a huge step forward for both of you. It'd be great.
Yeah, I'm hoping it will be. And I just think like the way things have gone in my recovery so far, I haven't known any other way to be than to just kind of make myself of service to my parents and whatever they asked of me, it's like one hand washes the other. And but what's happened over time is like I don't know. I think I haven't had much of a voice in the relationship in a while, and there have been some kind of like calcium deposits have built up. And I think that there's, you know, if I'm doing this, my healthy life, and you know, if I'm going to be present in this relationship, then I don't know. I just think there's other levels. And so that's just what I've been consumed with lately, is just this kind of feeling of, this relationship isn't going that well. Neither of us seem to be articulating ourselves as well as we probably could be. And there's maybe some juice to be squozing from that.
The timing of this reminds me of something I talk to addicts and families about a lot, which is, I call it the addict's karma. The basis part is this: it's to say to the recovering addict who's feeling good, maybe for the first time, like they're really doing something different. That you don't get to come in and ask for a lot for yourself for a while. It's like, you know, that basically these are the guys that a lot of times when aftercare, they can't figure out why everybody's mad at them, you know. And like the guy who taught me how to do aftercare said, he said that's because you're showing up. You know, you haven't been there for a while, and now you're there, and they're mad, and so you have that part of that. But when I work with clients who are early in recovery, They have legitimate concerns in their relationships, and they're going like, well, what about this? What about this person doing this? And I go, well, you know, that's real, and that probably needs to be done. But right now, what you're doing is you're in the process of demonstrating that you're true to your word at this point. That you're because a lot of times you say, well, I'm doing well. I'm in recovery. I'm doing this stuff. And most of the time you can say, yeah, but they've heard all those words before. You know, what they haven't seen is so it takes a while, and it's like, and so I like the idea. I don't think it has to be 6 years. I don't think it has to, you know, have to be a year. I don't think it has a particular time frame, but there's a time down the line where basically you've kind of rejoined, you know, in this case, the family. And it's like, okay, now, then you
when,
have,
Tom,
and
you though, have, when is that time? Is there a way to find out? Is there a litmus test?
Well, when you're ready, grasshopper.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you have and deserve some clout now, where you in the early part of your recovery, any of our recovery, for us to come in and start to ask for things. Well, I need you to do this different. That bullshit. You know, that's where I think, and I may be very biased this way. That's why it's really helpful to have a recovering addict as a counselor at that time, because they're the ones that look at you and go like, it doesn't matter how legitimate that is. You just need to wait. You know, it's like right now you're working off some karma.
Delayed gratification and
that's right.
Newly sober.
Yeah. But no, I think it's good timing for you, Patrick. It sounds great.
Well, I hope that whatever therapist we find is as good as you, because, you know, I think you're off the table, but I'll be shopping for, you know,
mm-hmm.
hopefully Absolutely. somebody who likes Westerns. Well, what do you say we read this Grapevine article as Alan would want, and then we can talk about it a bit before Joe has to go to his next commitment. Batter Up by Jenna W. from Kansas, Missouri. It took a while to warm up to the team, but thanks to the fellowship, she stepped up to the plate. I came into AA one December day. By spring, I was familiar enough with my home group to understand the announcements at the beginning of meetings. And there was one announcement I definitely paid attention to. Our group softball team will hold practice in the park this Sunday afternoon. I knew the park and had the day off that Sunday because it was Sunday, and also because I was unemployed, yet I refused to show up. Playing softball suddenly didn't seem like an option for me. I was a newcomer and an introvert who didn't exactly want to be noticed or seen in meetings. Luckily, I had a sponsor by then. I kept showing up to meetings with her.
Fast forward to the next spring. Announcements of sober softball practice started back up again. This time I had more sober time, knew a few more people in the program, but I was still too uncomfortable in my own skin to join everyone on the field. I showed up to a game early in the summer, mostly to find my sponsor and talk to her, and we watched them play. The team was one player short that game, but when I was asked if I could join, I refused. I'd intentionally worn the wrong shoes to ensure I couldn't play. Later in the season, my friend in the program started My friend in the program started playing on our group's softball team, and I showed up to a game to cheer her on. It was a special doubleheader. My AA group was the city park department turn. The field lights on to illuminate the field on the hot summer night. I knew many members from our home group who came to watch, and I enjoyed talking with members in the stands late into the night.
As the days got shorter and the softball season wrapped up, I finally decided to play at one of the last games of the year. I made sure to go to a meeting beforehand and to wear the right shoes. When I got to the game, I realized I knew almost everyone on the team. Since I had no equipment, a member lent me her glove and asked if I could be the catcher. As a lone wolf, I hadn't played in team sports in decades. It was wonderful to feel the ball in my glove as I caught each pitch and used my arm to catapult it back to the pitcher. When it was my turn to bat, I noticed how calm I was in the batter's box. The nervousness I had felt as a newcomer amazingly had been replaced by serenity. The first pitch was lobbed toward home plate, and I figured, why not swing since this seems like a good one? Wow, base hit. I got on first, and my friend was on second. We were both driven home by the next batter, a newcomer I'd never met before that night, but felt compelled to give her an exuberant high five with the dugout. After the game, I was struck by the spiritual growth I had to undergo to have fun that night. The guide for living offered by AA is what transformed me from a fearful newcomer to a relaxed member of a fellowship, and for that, I am so grateful. Time to play ball.
So it's about the effect of time, right? Time and kind of like staying in, and the way that eroded her, whatever awkwardness she had, or like not feeling a part of, right? And eventually she was able to get there just by sticking around, right?
She came as much as best she could. I think I told a story the other day about one of these other things where, and I was talking to this particular client not long ago, and was telling her I tell about her a lot, which is when she first went to AA, she drove by AA, where she would drive by the meeting place, and she did that a few times, and then she progressed herself up to the place where she would drive into the parking lot. She would park, and she would stay for a few minutes and leave. She stayed a little bit longer in the parking lot and left. I mean, this was a long period of time. And then she went in. She stayed for 5 minutes. The first time she went in, she came back out. It's like, it's, and this is one of those hindsight things. I don't think either one of us could have identified what was being created at that point, but it's part of her history, it's part of her story. And it's like this woman who's writing this article, it's like it's really just going, go rolling with the punches, as Alan says in his books, or going with the flow. It's like, you do what you can. And isn't that what we're always telling people? It's like there's not there, I mean, we all have should. I mean, we have so much shoulds. We have some automatic anxiety. I've got anxiety in my body right now because as a reader of that thing, we were asked to play catcher of all things. Oh God, that made me nervous. I don't want to play if I'm brand new to a team, especially. I don't want to play catcher. There's too much pressure, So I could even from this far a distance, I can feel my anxiety come up. So I think the idea is what she's doing is she's respecting herself as she takes it as she can.
I mean, these sort of stories of going out in the world really speak of everything about emotional sobriety, right? Discovering novel solutions, accepting what is, living life on life's terms, all of these things are looking at our emotional dependencies. We got to work them out in real life, not sitting in a meeting reading in a book from a book, right? That's not where the growth is going to happen. And I play softball, and the first softball team I played on was a recovery sort of 12-step thing. And there's some funny stories to tell about that. But I got asked to play on somebody else's team, and someone else had a tournament. Could I come on the weekend? And eventually, just like I do it with everything, within 2 years, I was playing on six teams, right? You know, like just like I would.
That sounds like you
run from the 6:30 game with mm-hmm. my cleats still on, driving my car mm-hmm. to be there on time for the 8 o'clock team mm-hmm. game on a different diamond, a different mm-hmm. part of the city. And I was talking earlier about, you know, just realizing I'm happy and not having the muscles for that. And, you know, like I have a brain that, you know, has a critical mind that thinks I'm misbehaving if I'm having fun. Like, you yeah. don't have time for fun. You've got this to do and you've got that to do and this deadline and that deadline. I was playing softball and I realized, you know, I should enjoy this while I'm doing it. You know, yeah, not make a chore out of it, not make a duty mm-hmm. out of it, right? Not make every at bat, you know, the weight of the team on my shoulders. Just have some fun. And I think that's easy to forget for some of us, but everybody should have something they'd rather do than go to their meeting, right? You know, like play music, go see a show, you know, dance. You know, we need something in our life beyond. There's a time for our whole job is recovery. I get that. But we need to grow out of that and find other passions and interests and other meaning in life. Beyond just, you know, staying clean and sober another day.
That's beautiful. That's right. Well, it's very similar to something I say to clients a lot of times. I say, you know, say in therapy, the therapy is the locker room. You know, the playing field's out there. It's like, you know, we're gonna talk about things. We're gonna work on things. We're gonna run some drills. We're gonna do all this stuff. But when you go out on the playing field, and it's like that's where you're going to put your recovery into practice. And that's where it really makes it where everybody has to do that part. And it's like, if you want to make it work and it's well said, Joe.
Well, on a visceral level, when I read that story, I thought of the wedding I just went to where I danced, and I'm fearful, very fearful of dancing.
Yeah.
And I think that part of what got me over that threshold. And by the way, I don't know how to dance. I was very terrible at it, but the collective kind of power energy of the room, and like the fact that I felt safe and I did not feel judged, and everybody was up on the floor dancing, and it seemed like it would be fun regardless of how I looked and how it was schlepping around. I got to be a part of that, and I think like there's a similar energy in rooms of recovery, you know, when you get enough people there that are really looking after each other, people can unlock all kinds of abilities they thought they were ill-suited to.
Yeah. I love listening to you there. This is just a little aside, but there was a little guy on your committee that about a third of the way in there said, tell them that you can't dance and you're not any good at dancing. Cause you know, because they might actually think that you have a positive view of your dancing. And so you stopped and said, I can't dance. I'm not good at dancing. It's like, you know, and I just know that guy in my head who just says, you know, please don't mistake me for somebody who has confidence.
I call you that know? Guy. He's the anthropologist. He's just calling it like it is. Okay.
Well, yeah. Keep in mind, I'm a complete idiot. Okay, everybody, it's all right now. I'd like to give you my point of view.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, and I don't deserve to be here.
Well, I deserve to be here, but you know, I'll still be schlepping on that dance floor.
You know, and I'll speak for somebody who I don't have anything. I don't think I can dance well. I don't know what that is, but it's like, but especially at weddings, my wife and I love to dance, man. It's like. And we're even as old people, when we get to go to a wedding, we're the first ones on the dance floor. We stay there all night long. It's like, you know, we're like Joe in a softball league. We just keep doing it with everybody.
Too much is just enough.
That's right. Well, we are addicts. Come on, give us a break.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up today, you know, Joe, is there anything you got going on, events that you can plug for our audience?
Oh, yeah. Alan Berger is doing an event on the 13th, and so am I. I'm going to be in Langley, BC. It's just outside of Vancouver, and it's the
July 13th?
Secular BC AA Roundup. It's a one-day thing, and there's a bunch of speakers. I'm doing a workshop on Chime, which we talked about earlier. Look who's popping in. He can have my seat. Alan, it's good to see you, man. And otherwise I'd love to go to Alan's thing, right? Just 20 people, it's going to be great. And there's going to be someone from the host committee from the Vancouver International Convention in 2025, just sort of talking about, you know, where to stay and what's going on and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, and then off to the International Conference of Secular AA. Alan's going to be there too in September. And I think I've got something going on, a book launch in, for a friend of mine in August. Bill Schaberg, who wrote Writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA, has a legacy book called 30 Things, Practical Advice for Living Well, which is really cool, and I'm quite excited about it. It's nice to, like, everything he does puts the focus on his subject matter, right? Now he's sort of turning the camera around to himself and his life, and, you know, it's going to be great.
I was going to say good morning, but for me, it's good afternoon. Some of you, it's good morning.
I'm looking forward to your thoughts on Batter Up, the latest AA Grapevine on emotional sobriety.
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it, that this individual was so uncomfortable. And I think one of the lessons to learn, well, there are many lessons here about emotional sobriety, but one thing is that it's, if we let our fear and our discomfort define us and what we do, our life is going to be very small. It's going to be very constricted and restricted, and unnecessarily so. I mean, as we found later on in the story, that this person, if they didn't let their fear or their fear define them, they would have been able to enjoy the game and enjoy that fellowship a lot earlier on. A very important message here is to not let one feeling, a negative emotion, define who we are. See, he believed because he was uncomfortable that he was not able to interact and be a part of. And it wasn't true. He really had that ability. It's just that the fear was what's standing in the way, not his ability, but the emotion that he was feeling. Now, the other thing is that it just does show also that there's an amazing growth that takes place if you just keep showing up. Because even though this person let that, the other thing that was really interesting, when he wore the wrong shoes so that he'd have a reason.
Absolutely, yeah.
See, that's the games we play with ourselves. We try to turn something wrong into something right. And it's not a good game we play with ourselves. It's not a good game because it really adds to keeping us stuck. But eventually, we also see the what takes place if someone keeps showing up regardless of that. So even though this person was uncomfortable and uncomfortable in meetings, they kept coming. And that's the other message here, is that what's true today won't be true tomorrow if you stay in the process, if you commit yourself to the process, you will change. Things will change in your life. There is no question about it. And I think that those are the two strong messages about emotional sobriety in this book. And, you know, you could see once he let his fear go, he actually was able to play quite well and enjoy the game, you know, immensely. So two very important lessons for our emotional sobriety.
Right. The fear, it exists, but it's not the only part.
Not the only part of us. And if we let it define us, it becomes all that we are. And it's not all that we are. It's just a part of us.
Yeah.
So happy 4th of July, everyone.
Happy 4th. And until next time.
All right, Patrick. Sounds good.
Thanks, Alan. Bye-bye.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.